Talkers.
Welcome to No Prize from God, episode 26. No Prize from God features conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. I'm your host, Ryan J. Downey, and my guest this episode is filmmaker Darren Lynn Bousman, perhaps best known as the director of Saw 2, Saw 3, and Saw 4. And he holds the distinction of being the first filmmaker to come on No Prize from God. This wide-ranging conversation includes the strange occurrences on the set of his 2011 film, 11-11-11, the quasi-religious story of 2012's The Devil's Carnival, his fascination with the strange, the occult, and secret societies, some book recommendations, and the religious and possibly supernatural themes throughout his latest film, Death of Me, which stars Maggie Q, Alex Esso, and Luke Hemsworth. Yes, brother of Chris Hemsworth and Liam Hemsworth. Plus, we even got a few tidbits about the next installment in the Saw franchise, Spiral, starring Chris Rock and Samuel L. Jackson, set for release in 2021. I watched Death of Me. I loved it. It deals a lot with identity, perception of reality, faith healing. You'll hear about some of the influences on the film in this conversation as well. And let me tell you what inspired me to have Darren on the podcast. It's a little statement that the publicity team for Death of Me sent out in the run-up to the movie's release, a few sentences written by Darren that resonated with me right away. It reads as follows. I have always been fascinated in belief, what people believe in, why they believe it, and the lengths they will go to for the things they believe in. I myself have a series of beliefs that people halfway across the world would consider insane, dangerous, or asinine. If you go back through and look at my library and my films, you will find this concept weaved into the last 10 years of my life and work. Death of Me's entire DNA is rooted in faith, the undying faith an island has for its well-being, prosperity, and survival. Upon reading the script, it tickled all parts of my mind that excited me. And more, it was thrilling and macabre, oh so macabre. After meeting with the film's producers and discussing our favorite horror films, it became obvious this was a film and opportunity I could not pass up. Not only was it a chance to film something in one of the most beautiful and unique locations I've ever set foot in, but get to work with some of the most fantastic and diverse group of actors and artists I've ever met. Death of Me is a special film. From the gorgeous cinematography from Jose David Montero, to the chilling score from madman Mark Seyfried. I'm excited for the world to understand and know the secrets our film's island holds for its inhabitants. And let me tell you, he's not exaggerating about that score. One of my favorite horror film scores in recent memory. Remember, the best way you can support this podcast and the conversations we have on it is to like and subscribe and to leave a 5-star rating and a nice review in Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. No Prize from God is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. Be sure to check out the all-new revamped NoPrizeFromGod.com, which has information about all of the episodes, information about the podcast itself, and some blog posts about related topics. You can find No Prize from God on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And you can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at Superhero HQ. So here it is, my conversation with Darren Lynn Bousman. This is No Prize from God. Searching the religion and spirituality categories in Apple Podcasts, you're confronted with any number of right-wing evangelical, you know, this and that, prosperity gospel, a lot of self-help, new agey type stuff. And then, you know, your kind of run-of-the-mill militant atheism of the last few years. And in scrolling, you know, they always say the best movies, the best bands, it all comes from like you making the thing that you wish existed.
Yeah.
And that was the genesis of this podcast, is I was like, well, where's the podcast for the rest of us? You know, where I could have on, you know, HR from Bad Brains, or, you know, all these people that I've encountered in my life who are creative, who make music, make movies, that have a unique perspective on this stuff that isn't in the orthodoxy. You know, you can't put it in a box of like, oh, it's Sam Harris. Oh, it's Joel Osteen. You know, it's like, it's nuanced, you know, it's interesting. So you're my first filmmaker on, and I'm happy to have you on, having watched this film, which is what made me really interested in it. But before we get into that, I wanted to ask you, we're both fellow Midwesterners. I grew up in Indiana.
Oh, nice.
And I moved out to California in 2001. And I've found since I've been here that my favorite people are not people from the Midwest and not people from California, but people from the Midwest who have moved to California.
That's hilarious. Well, I mean, it's funny because there is a, there's a sect of us out here. And it's, that's funny you say that, because I was just talking to someone the other day about how I've met more Midwest people out here than I actually knew when I was in the Midwest and doing that thing.
Totally. Yeah. When I first got out here, and my first job was as a reporter at MTV, and my office mate, just luck of the draw, grew up in Iowa. And it was like we grew up next door to each other, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think I'd even been to Iowa more than once or twice. And we're still really close friends, you know, 20 years later. And that, it's just interesting how there's something about certain values and things, I think, that we're instilled with in the Midwest, you know, hard work and whatever. But then also that drive to get the hell out of there.
Well, that's, hold on a second. I just lost you. Let me, I mean, I hear you, but hold on. What did I do with your window? Hold on.
It's behind other windows.
No, everything is closed, but I have, there you go. You're back. You know, that was the thing with the Midwest, is that I still feel like I have those Midwest ideals and upbringings, but living in LA. So part of me has a hatred of Los Angeles and disdain because they don't have those same values. And the other part of me is, when I go back to the Midwest, I got to get the fuck back to LA. I can't handle this.
Yeah. It's the ultimate definition of, you know, there's the saying, nice place to visit, wouldn't want to live there. The Midwest for me is nice place to grow up, don't want to live there anymore.
It's so funny. We talked about it with my kids. Like, I wish my kids had the childhood that I had in the Midwest. But again, I would want them to leave there at the time of 16 and not return. And there's some crazy, I just got back from the Midwest. Literally, I did a road trip with my son. And you get some wackos. You drive through, I guess what they call Trump's America, on the way from Los Angeles. And there's things out there that I just look at and I'm like, how was I around this for so long? And it's crazy.
Yeah. And it felt normal. Yeah. A friend of mine, another Midwest transplant, I steal this quote from him all the time. When he first got out here, he said, someone asked him, so how are you adjusting to California? And he said, dude, I was adjusting to Indiana my whole life.
Yeah.
That sums it up perfectly. Not to disparage our great places where we come from. And that's the interesting thing. I think the duality of the things we love and appreciate about those places. What drove us here. And now it seems like there's an exodus in the other direction. You hear about people leaving LA for...
Everyone's leaving. And, where do you live? What part of town?
I'm in the north part of Orange County, next to Seal Beach.
So, yeah, I mean, I would get the fuck out of LA right now if I could. You know, in fact, my wife and I are looking at trying to leave where we live and move an hour outside, whether it be towards Agora or Thousand Oaks, just because it's not the same place it was 10 years ago. And now you complicate that with everything going on in the world, and it's really not the same place it was. And it's actually going to be, honest with you, it's a little frightening. Like, I have a 5-year-old kid and we go out bike riding, and I'm more scared on my own street than I ever have found myself in any place I've ever lived.
Yeah.
So, you know, looking to try to get back out and try to find an in-between of my upbringing and where I live now.
Yeah. My kids are 7 and 12, and, my ex and I moved to Orange County about 5 years ago to be closer to her family. But we were for 10 years, we were out in Temecula, which is, you know, hour and a half outside of LA in the other direction, southeast. And I, and one of the things I liked about that area was it felt very Midwestern-y.
Yeah.
You know, while still being in California and also still being desert climate.
Absolutely.
So growing up, what were some of your first introductions to, you know, concepts about life's biggest questions, life, death, what does it all mean? Where do we come from? What were some of your early...
Well, I grew up...
indoctrination, but, you know, what were you kind of raised with and what did you find for yourself?
My grandfather was a Baptist minister. But he had retired by the time that I remember. I grew up going to church every Sunday, doing the whole confirmation thing. So church was not even a question. Like, we had to go to church every Sunday. However, my parents were very lax, I think, in their beliefs. My mother was very religious, but they would still, you know, it was never at a point of some of my cohorts or people that I grew up with that were over the top in their belief systems. We were still watching, you know, R-rated movies when I was 10 years old. And so it wasn't like oppressive in anything like that. It was you go to church on Sunday. That was what it was. So I grew up in kind of a religious household, but the older I got and the more that I became busy with life, the less and less I started going. Throughout high school, I just stopped going to church altogether. So I did grow up in that kind of respect. Being like my first kind of challenging thing, I'll tell you, my wife is Jewish. There's huge differences about just the way we live our lives, things like that. And coming to Los Angeles, you get such a different outlook than you do when you're in the Midwest or you're in Kansas. It's like an entirely different planet almost, because you live in this bubble and you think, oh, this is how everyone is. This is the world. But I think the older that I got and the more that I was able, and specifically to access information, the more that I began to question everything and really found myself struggling for what I not only actually believed in, but my own, I guess, moralistic core. You got to think that 20, 30 years ago, I was in college when I started getting emails on a weekly basis, not a daily, but I would check my email every Monday or Friday. It wasn't a big deal. Now I sit in front of the computer 10 hours a day and I research. Yeah. And yeah. So I think that the more access to information, the more that you know, my beliefs in life and everything began to change.
Indeed. Yeah. It's funny you say that about the email too. I remember a point in my adult life, you know, dating both of us, I suppose, but where I used to walk a couple blocks to a nearby computer lab at a university I didn't attend to get in and check my email. You know, that's how kind of unimportant it was. You know, I would do that maybe every other day.
Yeah. It's a scary thing because, you know, I have a son and a daughter, and my daughter's 2, my son's 5, and they both are just savants on the iPad, and mm-hmm. I'm locking my phone. And, you know, last night I finished a documentary on Netflix called The Social Dilemma,
which is,
I highly recommend it for anyone either with kids or without, but just about what's happening to our world due to the accessibility of information and social media. And it's scary because part of me thinks that I grew up kind of in the middle. For the first 17 years of my life, I did not have, I remember that I would go outside for 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock at night. And I never thought about TV or thought about going on the internet. Now I don't go outside less than 10 minutes without checking my phone or doing whatever. Mm-hmm. And now my son is only lived in a world where he has this constantly inundating him. So, you know, I'm concerned about what it looks like when he's my age now.
Yeah, man, absolutely. And especially when, you know, and this is maybe a rudimentary example, but it's demonstrative of, I think, some of the bigger things in play. That documentary, which has been on the tip of everyone's tongues the last 24 hours, it seems like. I didn't grow up, despite growing up in Indiana, I didn't grow up into sports. And in the last few years, one of my best friends has made it his mission to get me to like football. And once again, he lives in LA, works in the entertainment industry. He's from Cincinnati. originally. And so I've been going over to his place and watching Bengals games with him and his wife and friends and stuff for the last couple of years. So anyway, I tell you this to say that today, for the first time in my entire life, I Googled Burrow jersey, the new quarterback for the Bengals. First time I've ever Googled any sports jersey, NFL, anything in my life. Clicked on one link, left the window open to go back to later. And an hour later, I'm on Twitter, and the first promoted post in my Twitter feed was from the Bengals about that quarterback.
I will tell you that it's scarier than that, and this is why the future scares me. I guess the present scares me. I was in my room last week and a half ago, and I collect watches, and I looked down at one of these watch cases that I had, and I realized that one of my favorite watch straps, one of the favorite watches that I have, strap broke. And I said to my wife, I need to get a new watch strap for that. Now, my phone wasn't in the room, nor did I have my Apple iWatch on. So cut to the first time I opened the computer after that. First time, go to Facebook, every ad is for watch straps, every single ad. Now, my phone wasn't in the room with me, so it could not have been listening. So my thing is, what crazy smart device do I have that I'm not even realizing is listening to the shit that I'm saying? That is too strange of a coincidence that all of a sudden I mention a watch strap, and it's all watch straps on the right side of the screen. It's listening. It knows everything.
Yeah, and I think for people, us Gen Xers in particular, having grown up with the Terminator franchise and the Running Man, and what did I just rewatch the other day? Night of the Comet. I just watched that for the first time in a long time. You know, it's like film is part of the way that we communicate and get our ideas across and share ideas with one another. And having grown up speaking that language of some of those particular films, it makes this stuff that much more frightening, because you do hear, well, hey, I don't, you know, if it's data mining and figuring out stuff that I like and recommending things I want to buy, like that's easy. That's making my life more convenient. And it's like, yeah, what's the sinister thing behind that?
It's not. And this is what people say to me. I get in fights with a lot of people on this, a lot of my friends and even my wife. They're like, I don't have anything to hide. I don't care. That's bullshit. Everyone has something to hide. Every single person has something to hide that they don't want out there. And the irreputable damage that can occur if your private information got out. And I'll give you an example. Whether it be text messages when my wife and I fight, we send each other really shitty text messages. Or if I had a bad experience with an actor and I tell my agent, I fucking hate this person, blah, 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 blah. We all say things that we think are said in private and are not for public consumption, but the reality is someone has all that private information. Every time you use Siri, every time you do a search online, it's terrifying. There was a documentary that was a few years ago, and I think it's called Terms and Conditions May Apply, and it talks about how Google amasses your search history into what it is. It basically fills in the gaps of what you're doing. So insecurities that you have as a person, if you're Googling, you know, how do I lose 20 pounds? What is this rash? Whatever that thing is, Google knows more about you than anyone else. And I think that is terrifying, because they're putting profiles about you out there and they're selling those profiles. And that to me is terrifying, that you think you have these secrets, but is there any secret that I have that Google doesn't know about me? I don't know.
Yeah.
And that to me is terrifying.
Absolutely. And I think you also make a great point in terms of speech in general. And this is something that I think about a lot often, is there are, you know, kind of these silos, these certain relationships you have with people where you're going to say and do things that you wouldn't do in other relationships. And a lot of times that gets misconstrued as, oh, you know, this person's two-faced, or you're saying something here that you wouldn't say to that person's face. I think, no, it's more emblematic of having nuanced, different relationships that you get different things from. Of course, there's the other extreme of being totally fake and having 10 different faces to people. But in your, you know, case in point, a professional relationship that you have with your agent where you want to vent about an actor that you had a bad experience with and make sure your agent knows you're not interested in repeating that experience, it doesn't mean you're being duplicitous that you're not calling that actor and chewing them out. So there is that idea that like certain types of private speech that we're having among friends to various ends, the idea of that stuff getting out there is terrifying.
You mean you look at as well, you know, this thing that's happening now, which I think is a great thing, and we should purge the system full of horrific people and redistribute that power from the people of Weinsteins and all of this. But you look back over the case of 30 years from when I started using Twitter at when I was 16 or whatever the social media, MySpace, to now, when you realize that things that were said, be it on a public platform or private messages, are being used, and they're being used, and people are being taken down. And it's a scary thing to realize now. It almost feels like there is an out of control thing that you no longer, there is no such thing as privacy. There's no such thing as private conversation, and that anything can be taken out of context. And I had my first kind of experience with that a few years ago. I was doing an interview, and this is a bad example of what was said, but I mentioned something that we were talking about, how you doing today? And I said something like, not good. I don't feel good. And they said, why? And I said, too much tequila and really bad Mexican food. And then the quote that was taken said something like, Bausman's down on Mexican, or it said something like that. And then you'd have to click in the article to read what I actually said, but most people don't click in the article. They read those headlines. And so it's terrifying, because now I find myself with technology, second guessing, third guessing, fourth guessing every single statement or everything I type, self-censoring myself just completely. It's a weird time in the world we live in.
Indeed. And that circles us right back around to Google as well, because a headline like that is being written because it's SEO friendly, and because whatever outlet you did that interview with inevitably depends on Google ad revenue, and they have to do all the right things for the Google algorithms for their site to have the visibility that's going to generate the traffic that's going to pay their bills. And it all kind of goes back to this homogenization and corporatization of so much of our lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this does all tie into the theme of this podcast pretty well, in terms of belief and some of these things that maybe there are religious allegories for throughout different holy texts from different faith traditions about apocalypse and the end of the world, and things that fundamentalists take literally and others not so much. I feel like so much of that's kind of happening around us, not to be too doomsday about it, but even what we're talking about in terms of privacy and AI and being tracked and all of that,
it's funny. All of my, not all, but I would say the last four or five of my movies have all kind of dealt with my own shit as it relates to faith and religion and what I'm going through in my own mind constantly. In this movie, definitely being one of them as well, which I think kind of gets into the idea of belief. It's easy to look at any culture and call them ridiculous or think that their beliefs are absurd. But then you look at, like, I grew up believing that if I ask wishes to a man in the sky, he would cure my parents' cancer. How is that any more ridiculous than some of these other things that we're led to believe? And again, part of my fascination with the internet has brought for me is it's allowed me to go down the deep, dark rabbit hole of beliefs and religion and other cultures, what they believe. And I think it is a dark rabbit hole, because right when I think I have it figured out, I realize and read something else that either invalidates my current belief or opens me up to something completely different that I wasn't thinking about at all.
The fact that you can do that, though, I think is so key. I think the biggest danger in philosophical thought and theological thought is certainty. And that's something that I've come to in my adult life very recently, just in the last few years, where certainty is the enemy. For all these years where I thought that what I was searching for was certainty and for, knowing the big answers to the big questions, I've started to find that I'm, was maybe asking the wrong questions, and that I'm more comfortable in the mystery and in the uncertainty and the doubt of all of this stuff than arriving at some conclusion where it's like, okay, here's what it all means. And
I think that's where you get fanatical people that you see on the news that to me seem kind of ridiculous. Sometimes they're so sold in what it is they believe in, they'll accept no other explanation.
Right.
That's why I love the occult and esoteric, is that I'm a huge fan. I collect old occult books and old Freemason stuff and old, Tempest Day. I collect all of these old things, and I love the aesthetic and look of them, but I love reading the text, because you're like, oh shit, yeah, that actually makes sense. And it scares me that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, a lot of these movies that I've kind of been dealing with, it's my own exploration into shit that I'm reading or rabbit holes that I've gone down. And I find it scary. I don't know if you saw, there's a movie, Kevin Smith made it, I think, a few years ago called Red State, which deals with, again, fanaticism and how far people go in their beliefs. You know, I try to be as open-minded as possible anytime I, you know, read anything, because it's, you know, I think the one certainty is there is no certainty. You're never going to know it. You're not going to figure it out in your lifetime.
And a lot of us gravitate towards things just like we do in the news cycle that are predisposed to our confirmation bias, you know? So we might end up reading, you know, we're trying to deepen our knowledge about faith and what we believe. We end up reading things that lean towards what we want to think or where we have been. So yeah, I think that what you said is really key about just being open to new information and all of that. When do you first remember becoming interested in the more occult stuff, the more esoteric kind of fringe out there? I've always had that fascination as well from almost as long as I can remember.
So I've always loved the dark and the macabre, and you know, I think the earliest kind of introduction into it is Satanic Panic kind of idea. You know, there was a big craze of, you know, whether it be Anton LaVey or anything Satan oriented, because it's the easiest doorway into it, because it's the easiest thing to point out as bad and evil. Mm-hmm. And so growing up in Kansas, there were always legends and rumors of, oh, that's a satanic temple, or that there's a place in Kansas called Stoll, Kansas. If you don't know about it, Google it. It's crazy. It was supposedly this demonic church that was torn down, and there's crazy stories around it. Back in the days when horror movies were being made, you know, if you were dealing with the occult, it was very much always Satanism, Satanism, Satanism. So I think that was the first kind of idea into it. But as I got older, you realize it's not so white and black. It's, you know, the idea of a lot of Satanist belief isn't about a demon or anything like that. It's a way of life. It's putting yourself above all others. And so you start to realize that things were skewed from my memory as a kid, that it wasn't as white and black as that. But it started really for me, I was a poser for most of my life in horror, where, you know, I loved Michael Myers and I loved Freddy Krueger, and so I made horror movies. Then I started dealing with weird occult kind of stuff, and I realized I knew nothing about it. So I started researching, and it started with secret societies always for me, that secret societies always had a belief, and that belief a lot of times skewed into esoteric kind of teachings and beliefs. And those would lead me down rabbit holes of you know, different theories. 11-11-11, which is a terrible movie I made. I think I actually kind of went crazy making that movie, because that was my first deep dive into it, where I was just consuming as much information onto the weird and unexplained as I could.
And that was one that you wrote and directed also.
Yeah. And so that whole experience of making that movie was crazy. We went to Spain and shot it, and I am very pragmatic in my belief and thought. I've never seen anything supernatural. I've never seen a UFO, but there was some crazy shit that took place on that movie that is so unexplainable. And couple that with the lack of sleep and my researching what was supposed to be researched in that movie, I kind of just lost my shit for a bit. And so it's a bad movie. The experience of making it was as much more engaging than what actually ended up on screen. But that movie kind of changed everything for me. And I think my belief system and researching things. And that's where I started realizing the internet, like I was changing years of belief based on new things that I was reading, because I had access to the net, which I never had access to that kind of stuff before. So it was doing that movie that I actually started to see that my whole beliefs were changing at the same time.
You know, what's interesting about that too is when you think about those, you know, classic sort of film folklore about supernatural horror films and their productions, you know, whether it's The Omen, you know, The Exorcist, even going forward into something like The Crow, you know, these movies that deal with life and death and the occult and supernatural and all that sort of stuff. And then you hear about all these, you know, tragedies and mishaps and bizarre happenings. It's almost like the way you're describing the process of 11-11-11 is that it fit very much in that canon. You know, this happens to be the themes of this movie, and we're also living it as we're making the movie. Well,
I will tell you that there's so much, but I could do 4.5 hours on that movie and the weird shit that happened, but it was so crazy and it was so batshit insane, the things that were happening, that the production company who was making the movie and distributing it would not put out the behind the scenes footage because it looked so staged. And wow. And it did. Like you look at it and you're like, this isn't real. This can't be real, the shit that we're seeing right now. You know, one of the things that was crazy is the weeks leading up to the cinematographer arriving. He was an American cinematographer who I've worked with a ton, named Joseph White. I was texting him and I was like, dude, you would not believe the shit happening out here. It was one location. It was a house. And I was like, you would not believe the shit happening out here. And he was like, it's bullshit, man. You're falling into hype. You're crazy. Every day I was like, dude, you don't understand how fucked up this is. Joe shows up. We drive to the house and immediately he walks in and he stops. And he was just like, he's like, that's fucked up. And I was like, what? He's like, I feel it. He's like, you walk in and you feel it. But wow. So he goes through, we're walking through the house and he was like, dude, you know what, man, I'm pushing this out. This is nothing. This is all in our head. This is fucking stupid. As he says it, a chandelier dislodges out of the ceiling and knocks him on the head. He's sent to the ER. The angle of which is goddamn chandelier, this thing falls, was impossible. It was an impossible trajectory to fall. Massive injuries occurred on the set. No, massive injuries. From people being pushed down the stairs and breaking legs to falling into weird potholes in the ground that weren't there hours before, to people quitting due to hallucinogens that they thought there was a gas leak in the house. So we kept trying to figure it out, being like, this is not this, there is a logical explanation for this. There is a gas leak, because that would make sense. People are loopy, whatever. So that the whole experience was so batshit crazy in that I started. Again, it just propelled my research into the weird. There was another book that I recommend. It's a great gateway drug into kind of weird beliefs. is a book called Will's Store Versus the Supernatural. If you've never read it, it's a really light read, but it's fun and it's great. And it was basically this reporter, a journalist, and it was either Vanity Fair or Harper's Bazaar. He worked at a very big publication, was doing a Halloween issue. And they ask him to follow this basically exorcist type of person. And they wanted to follow him on Halloween. And so he who believes in that, this is a true story. He who believes in nothing. And this guy is like, I'm completely agnostic. I don't believe in anything. He goes out and he follows this guy and he immediately realizes it's fake. He was like, I can see the tricks. I understand how it's being done. And so he exposed this guy on the tricks in the article. And the guy said, I don't think you're understanding what's actually happening. Come with me again and let me show you what's really happening. So this guy, Will Store, goes with him again. And this time he can't understand any of it. It doesn't make any logical sense. So he takes a sabbatical from the magazine and follows this guy around for 12 weeks. And each chapter is a different time that he's with the guy. And it's just a fascinating look at the bizarre and supernatural. It's called Will Store Versus the Supernatural. It's one of my favorite books on the subject.
I'll check that out. And do book recommendations are very welcome on this podcast. And, you know, hearing that makes me think about how, you know, I feel like there's an evolution when you're raised in a certain faith tradition where various rituals and symbols and things like that have this rich meaning to you as you're young. And then you get to that age, you know, usually adolescence, where you start looking at it as like, these are just a bunch of symbols and rituals and they don't mean anything. There's no magic here. And I feel like the truth is probably somewhere more in the middle, almost like what it sounds like that book is describing, where on its surface, like I can see all the tricks this guy's doing. And this is like some, you know, shell game con job that he's pulling on people who believe in this stuff. And then also, you know, that somewhere in the theater of all of that and the ritual of all of that is where the magic actually exists, in the margins of it.
I think the power in a lot of this comes in the faith that you put into it. You give it power by your belief. And I think, you know, there is power in the cross. If you put 1,000 people in a room and they're, you know, believing in it and they're putting forth their, you know, belief into it. I think that you give symbols power and you give sigils power by what you put into it. So, it's a fascinating thing.
Absolutely. And I think that speaks even to, you know, beyond religion. I think there's a religious magic sort of appeal, attraction disgust, whatever it makes you feel. There's visceral feelings that you get from different symbols, whether they represent political ideologies or, you know, what have you. So for you to go from 11-11-11 and having that experience, because I think the next movie after that was Devil's Carnival, right?
Yeah. So Devil's Carnival was, again, it's another whole kind of, we wanted to make it's a quasi-religious story about, you know, we changed it. What if Lucifer was a good guy? What if he runs this, you know, it's this kind of misunderstood person that's suffering as well. And so in some respects, it's extremely sacrilegious, but we wanted to make it fun and campy. And, you know, I love rock and roll and I love that type of music. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of combined there are some things at the surface are pretty rough. Like, there's some great lines in there. Like, I'm not in the business of killing little children. That's God's jurisdiction. Like, just things that are really horrific that at the surface aren't great. But I think the idea was just to show a different side of it. Mm-hmm. So we went into Devil's Carnival. I think you're right. I think it was right after that.
Yeah. So it's crazy but it's interesting that you came out of that experience, and some people might have run from it and said, like, you know what, I'm going to do a romantic comedy after going through all that, you know, and instead you're like, I'm going to do a movie about the devil, you know, like, you kind of went right into the fear and the unknown, which I think is always admirable and interesting to me.
Yeah. I think that, it was funny. My son, I did something really stupid. When my kid was about three and a half, four, we went to Universal Studios we live right next to Universal. He loved it. And he loves, you know, seeing the Minions and doing all of this. And, you know, we went on all the rides that he could go on, and we were leaving, and there was the tram ride. And I, being a fucking idiot as a parent, took him on the tram ride, not even thinking that King Kong is terrifying. It's terrifying for a kid his age. So we go through the tram ride. He sees King Kong and he fucking loses it. He just can't handle it. He's crying. He's hyperventilating. And for the next 2 weeks after King Kong, all he wanted to do was talk about it. He wanted to talk about it. He wanted to understand it. He kept asking me a million questions about it. And you realize that kids deal with fear by trying to understand. And so they don't get off it. They lean into it. And I think in some respects, that's what I do with my own shit that I'm dealing with in my head, is I just lean into it. So if I'm dealing with something in my life, it usually finds its way into my movies, and I just lean into it.
That brings up an interesting thing too about, you know, even from the sort of, let's say, secular side of life. I did an interview recently with this guy, Paul DeGeller, who's one of the faces of Shark Week, and he's a double amputee. He was an elite bomb disposal unit diver for the Australian Navy, and was attacked by a 9-foot-long bull shark on a routine training mission, lost literally an arm and a leg. And now he's not only like a foremost expert on sharks, he's an advocate for sharks and does all of this educational work, and you know, did a series with Nat Geo where they went after poachers, and, you know, he's vegan, he's big into the sea shepherd. And his perspective, as he explained it to me, was, you know, he's like, after, you know, my shark incident, the media would often come to me whenever there was another shark attack or a shark sighting, and I'd be someone they'd want to have on to talk about it because I had been through it. And he goes, so I decided I didn't want to sound like an idiot every time I was on TV. So I started researching sharks, and through that process, you know, fell in love with them. And that was his whole thing, was like, most fear is fear of the unknown. And the more you face that fear and confront it by diving into it and trying to wrap your head around it and understand it, the less scary it becomes. And right. Yeah, I'm like you. I you know, grew up reading Fangoria, and, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street was my favorite movie. It still is, in the horror genre. And also had that entryway via Satanic Panic, and, you know, seeing Anton LaVey on like Phil Donahue or whatever, you know, and the theatricality of all of it, and the surface sort of appeal of it. What's most disarming about it is when you go watch, especially through the lens of 2020, no pun intended, if you go watch an old clip of Anton LaVey doing a TV interview now, it's like everything he says is totally reasonable.
Well, you know, what's funny is that there was a documentary last year, a year and a half ago, called Hail Satan. And I recommend watching it because it's funny, again, when you're growing up and you see these things, they are so taboo and they're so evil. And you have the parents being like, you know, worried about the, again, the satanic panic kind of thing. But when you actually go in, they're reasonable. When you watch Hail Satan, it's a group of basically artists who are turning their nose up at the establishment and saying things like, how is it acceptable that you can put the Ten Commandments on the lawn, but you can't put Baphomet? And so they fight for Baphomet, not because they believe in a demon god, but because they're saying it's not okay to have one without the other. If you're going to put the Ten Commandments up there, we want our statue up there as well. And then you start realizing what they're actually saying is it's challenging these diehard people who believe in something because that's all they've ever been exposed to versus free thinking. And I found that documentary fascinating. It's called Hail Satan. It's pretty awesome. It's a pretty awesome look at that.
And that's about the Temple of Satan guys, right? Who are Church of Satan.
Yes. Different, completely different thing. They are more, again, it's not dealing with, I guess when I was a kid and I was watching things like that, I thought it was dealing with a weird demonic god and all of this. And
neither of them are. If anything, no. I would say there's a vague tinge of right wing leaningness about Church of Satan and then a leftist bent to Temple of Satan, which is interesting because it's like neither of them are actually about supernatural deities. It's really fascinating. So I want to jump into this current film and ask you first a little bit about the process. You didn't write this one, but it does have your fingerprints on it and that stamp in terms of belief. And there was that great director statement that you put out about belief and how it's involved in this film, which I'll put that in the show notes. What was the early sort of production process? Like, how did this come across your desk? And how did you know that you could put your voice into it and make it yours?
Any movie that deals with religion to me or belief or faith is something that I'm always a fan of. You go back and some of my favorite movies growing up, be it The Omen or The Exorcist, or even Wicker Man, something like that.
I was going to say, not to cut you off, but I meant to say this in my question. This film reminds me of two of my favorite horror films of all time, which are The Wicker Man and Serpent in the Rainbow.
Both of them are huge inspirations. And, if I could blatantly steal every scene of Wicker Man, I would.
I love that you reference Wicker Man in the film.
Exactly.
10 minutes after I thought of Wicker Man, that joke happened and I was like, ah.
Yeah. So anytime that there's a movie that kind of deals in religion, I want to read it. I love it. And so this didn't necessarily deal with religion. It dealt with faith and it dealt with belief and it dealt with the original script. It dealt with voodoo. And so I read it and my concern, it was a lot of logistical concerns about where we could film this and set this to make it believable. But I had seen a fair number of movies that dealt in kind of the voodoo belief. And I said, is there any way to take the same idea of the story, which is that I love the high concept hook, which is a woman and husband wake up with no recollection of the night before and they search their phone and they find this video of the man killing the woman, but they're both very much alive. So I thought that was a great hook, like a horror version of Hangover.
I didn't even make that connection. That's great. Yeah.
How can I do that in a little more unique way that did not rely on the concept of voodoo dolls and all of that, which it originally did? So we started doing some research and we found a book that talked about a belief that dealt with, a thing in Southeast Asia a long time ago called pillars. And the idea of this pillar was, is that this town would basically bury or sacrifice people in the pillar of town, with the center of town, which basically would watch over and protect the town. And upon digging up these pillars, they would find bones of what they assumed to be pregnant women. And so that Steve Lehman idea took the idea, okay, can we expound this mythology and do it in that kind of way. So that's where the idea came from. But what I kind of love about it, and what I loved Wicker Man, is when you watch Wicker Man, the people of the island are not bad people. They're not nefarious serial killers. They are people that have a belief, and they believe that they need good harvest and good crops and good health. And so to do that, it requires a sacrifice. Well, there's been sacrifices in in our world since the dawn of time. That's not a new thing.
I mean, that's the Christian story, is Jesus is the ultimate sacrifice.
Exactly. So knowing that sacrifices are so prevalent in religion, you know, we just took that idea of imagine a town where they're not evil, they're not bad, they just require a sacrifice, and this woman will be this chosen sacrifice. And I think some of my favorite things in the script are not the violence and the gore and the supernaturally thingies. It's the small moments where you see people bowing to her as she walks down, or people giving her gifts.
Hugging her. Like, oh, thank you.
Exactly. Love those. I love those type of things, because you realize that, you know, it's an honor what she's doing for them. It's she should be honored that she's giving her life to save thousands. And I think that's just a scary, scary thing. And on top of that, you have a stranger in a strange land. You know, they're stuck here through circumstance, through the storm that's bearing down on the island. They can't get out, and no one's speaking English to them outside of really the woman Alex Essos, where they live. And I love that idea from shooting all over the world. One of the scariest things is you're in a place and you can't communicate. And to me, that's always a thing, is how to work up that kind of communication. So all of those elements together, I thought could be really cool. And I had a chance to go to Thailand, which I've never been, and to shoot a movie there, I thought would just been an awesome thing. So that's all kind of came together.
Yeah. And, you know, and from an optics standpoint, I don't know that you could make Serpent and the Rainbow right now in the same way, where it's, you know, a white person immersed in the foreign land of Haiti. And I thought that was a really smart choice and a very progressive way to tell this story, in that you have, you know, as your lead, this Vietnamese American actress who got her start in Hong Kong. So it immediately eliminates that feeling of like, oh, this is a story where the terror is the other, because they're Asian. You know, it's like, no, they're other because they're other. This is like different culture, different belief system. Yeah.
We struggled. You know, one thing that it concerns me is we do live in a different age now. You can't make movies like you could 30 or 40 years ago, nor I think should you.
Right.
So one of the concerns that I had is that if you're making them the killers of this woman, whether it's nefarious or not, I didn't want us to portray them as villainous. So one of the things that we tried to do was there's a couple of lines in there we talk where they say, these are people that have come from all over. And if you go back and watch the movie, two of the biggest proponents of this are Westerners. It's Alex Essos' character and like the guy at the diner, the beach cafe, that are pushing her on this kind of thing. So that was something important to me, to say that this was not about a place, it was about a belief. And the belief could spawn from whether you're Asian or you're Western or whatever it is you are. So that was something that we tried to do.
And I love that there's, you know, in this whole conversation about religion and belief and everything, I love that this film grapples with, which wasn't something that I saw coming, and not that I don't think it's any kind of spoiler, but it grapples with the idea of free will.
Yeah.
It grapples with identity, faith healing. You know, there's a lot of different things happening. Our perceptions of reality. I love that early on in the film, the idea of a hallucinogenic is introduced, because it leaves you as the audience questioning various things as they're unfolding. And you know,
well, that's something that for me as a viewer, I love movies that give me an out if I choose not to believe the supernatural. And I think that was something that we really wanted to do, is we wanted to make sure that you could watch this and believe that it was a supernatural thing at play, or every scene before she has one of these visions, she's dosed. And we give you both versions. So if you notice, every time Maggie does something, either she's drinking something right before it, whether Alex Essos is pushing her, here, have a shake, have this smoothie, or the doctor's being like, here, try this, put this on you, or she's going to the diner and getting the soup or the cafe. That we try to give you two parallel things happening here. So if you wish to believe that it's the drug, the Namum Pry, it's given to you, and it's also showing this other thing as well, which is the island's power.
Yeah, I socially distanced watched the film with a friend of mine last night, also a horror nerd, and that was the first thing I said to him when it was over. Is I said, it's one of those movies where you can say this was all, you can have a practical, logical explanation for everything you saw. Or it can all be magic. I love that too.
Love that, is like when you look at movies like Jacob's Ladder and things like that. I think that the coolest part of those type of movies is it allows the audience to think what they want to think and doesn't mm-hmm. say either's right or wrong.
Because that's life.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Like that's how we have to look at all of these things in life.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I love, you know, and I think both of us being lovers of music, I've often identified that a lot of my favorite bands, you know, you can see the components and the ingredients, but it's that combination of things that haven't been combined before. And then through the unique lens of the people who are making that music, that creates something new. So it's like, yeah. you can look at Metallica and go, well, there's Motorhead and there's Diamond Head. And, yeah. but it's like, but then it's like, you got this Danish guy and this guy from, you know, yeah. Russian scientist parents. And it's like, it all turns into its own thing. And that's the thing I really, number one, loved the absolute most about this film. And I gravitate, because I'm into these ideas and conversations. I gravitate towards movies like this anyway.
Yeah.
But I love that there were those little elements of other things without being copies, you know, without being
yeah.
clones of any of those movies. And it made me think about, gosh, what was I going to say? Because there was one other, I was thinking a lot about Servant in the Rainbow and Wicker Man, but there was something else in there. It's escaping me now. But, oh, I know what it was. The first time you see the green drink. Here, have yeah. some juice. I thought, yeah. ah, Rosemary's Baby.
Rosemary's Baby, the tanner. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that way, yeah. and it was nice because if you speak that sort of language of film, it gives you a clue as to what's coming without being a spoiler, you know, it's like kind of a harbinger, whereas, and if you don't, then you miss it, and it doesn't yeah. hurt or, you know.
Rosemary's perfect. Baby is one of my absolute all-time favorite, not only books, but movies. It is, you know, Ruth Gordon's character in that is my one of my favorite, and 100% Alex Esso's is ripped off of Ruth Gordon, that character, because it's the overly nice person that is manipulating without realizing that they're manipulating. Here, drink this, have a drink, you know, wear the necklace. It's 100% yeah. the Ruth Gordon character in Rosemary's Baby.
I love it. And those characters are often the most sinister. Because it's all kindness and smiling, and I love, yeah, as you said, when you're somewhere that you can't communicate and so on and so forth, you immediately gravitate to that character because you feel that she's some kind of anchor in reality yeah. that our protagonists understand.
Exactly.
So super cool. Well, I gotta ask you this before I let you go. You know, the next thing, obviously being this Saw franchise, which is where yeah. most people know you from, and obviously looks very exciting and people are really interested in this one. Given everything we just talked about and all the themes of this podcast and so many of the ideas that percolate and go through all of your films, is there any of this sort of stuff that show, cause you know, Saw is sort of the opposite of a supernatural horror, but yeah. is there, do you get to grapple with any of life's big questions in this upcoming movie?
Yeah, you do. It doesn't, it's not a religious kind of thing, but it absolutely deals with, specifically Chris Rock's character, is dealing with, some baggage, which I think many others will find themselves dealing with, more so in a relationship with father and son, which, with, Samuel Jackson plays his dad. So, you know, we definitely get into stuff like that. And we definitely get into philosophies. I think one of the things I love about the Saw franchise in general is the philosophies of what the killer is doing. If you go back and watch what Jigsaw is doing, it's a philosophy. He's trying to basically teach people to appreciate what they have, their life, because there's so many out there that don't have that opportunity. They're dying of cancer, whatever. And then you look and you see someone smoking a cigarette and you're realizing my dad or whoever died of lung cancer. And here you are having a cigarette. Do you realize how fucked up this is? So I love that about the Saw franchise. And I think that Spiral definitely has a lot of that at play. Too early to tell you what that is yet, but there is definitely some sure. stuff there.
Awesome. Yeah. And you're right. And Jigsaw is definitely motivated by a belief, which I think is, yeah,
absolutely.
That's what makes the most compelling. I mean, you know, I tell my own kids that the best stories are the ones where the villain thinks they're the hero.
You know? Absolutely. No villain thinks he's the villain. And I think that that's what makes him, specifically Jigsaw, because he's, if you really listen to what he's saying, I kind of buy into it. It's like, he's taking it to the extreme, but it makes sense. And he's definitely not the villain in his story at all.
Yeah. And of course, Chris Rock's character, his detective, is named Ezekiel, which is, you know,
yes,
not lost on me.
a nice religious name there.
Yeah, the significance of that. Last thing, Max Minghella.
Yes.
Just tell me about working with him.
He was incredible. And I think that there's certain actors that there's a gravitas when they step mm-hmm. on set. I mean, first off, he comes from like this insane family. Like his father is this an insanely talented director. But he is, there was a weight when he stepped on set. And there was something, he would hyper-focus on every word that he said. And he had to make sure that that word not only made sense to him, but he could sell it in a believable way. There's certain actors you get that look at the script and say, okay, I'll say this. And you get other actors like Max that's like, why am I saying this? Explain to me why I'm ending a sentence in a preposition. Is that because I didn't go to school or I'm trying to fit? I mean, he was very hyper-focused into every word that he said. And he's awesome. He is awesome in the movie, and he was awesome to work with.
He comes from such a cool lineage, as you mentioned. And I really loved him in The Handmaid's Tale. Because he was, like you said, he has a certain, he's young, but he has a certain gravitas where he really anchors.
Absolutely.
Those kind of actors can anchor a wild story in some reality by just coming across as so.
I 100% agree.
Heavy. So, well, dude, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I was really excited to make it happen and to also really, you know, it's been musicians and authors on the podcast so far, and I've really wanted to open the door to filmmakers.
Well, it's awesome being on, man. Thank you so much for having me. And I will tell Shawnee you said hello.
Please do. Awesome, man. Thanks so much. Have a good rest of your day.
All right, bye.
Bye.